The Football Kickoff
with Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
We'll get to our Antonio Conte discussion and our poll. We'll get to our five-a-side. We'll tell you about the five games that we're going to watch this weekend. But before we do all that, I'm going to welcome Damien Delaney and Phil Egan to the show. You're both very welcome. Damien, I might start with you. Some breaking news this morning that Adam Ida has a meniscus injury and is out for the rest of the season at least. This is really disappointing for somebody who we thought had turned a corner at Norwich and found a manager who really loved him.
Yeah, it's a catastrophic injury for him, really. You know, he was just getting into a run of form, started showing signs that he was really picking up the bits and pieces you need to be a Premier League footballer. Seriously impressive over the last number of weeks. And he should have been looking down the barrel of a strong finish to the season, getting some more Ireland caps and maybe reproducing some of that late form in an Ireland jersey. So it's catastrophic for him. But from a positive point of view, the end of the season always sounds a whole lot worse. It's now the middle of February, so it's only a couple of months and it's only a meniscus injury. You know, when you hear people out for the season, you worry if it's, you know, medial ligaments or cruciate ligaments or something a touch more serious. But a meniscus injury, you know, it'll take its time, and he's young enough. He's only 21 years of age. So they're the negatives and the positives, really, in one spin.
Yeah, we don't really get that much information from clubs. I mean, if we think back to last week when the press conference was on, it was like, oh, it's a matter of weeks, not months, before he's going to be back. And then the news comes through that they're sitting him down for the rest of the season. We don't know if there's surgery involved. There could well be. It could be something that heals with rest. But either way, is the meniscus something that footballers kind of look at each other and go, oh, you dodged the bullet there?
No, not at all. I think it's I don't want to kind of talk about near and not qualified it, but it's not overly serious. Meniscus is cartilage, really. You know, you could have a tidy up job and be back in a number of days, really, once you heal from the effects of the surgery. Possibly he's got something maybe floating around in there. But it's not a major injury, not at all. I mean, it's something you can absolutely overcome. The length of it, length of time, really, it's maybe 8 weeks is 2 months that takes really pretty much the end of the season. So that's why they're probably writing that off. So maybe it is a touch more serious than just a tidy-up operation. But, you know, it's nothing major, especially for a 21-year-old guy.
The other news I think that was coming through about Andre Omondale this morning?
Yeah, he's gone to see a consultant. So he hasn't been able to train fully. He's got a back issue, so he's gone back to see a specialist about that. And in terms of Ida, it looks like the surgery's already been done.
Right.
He saw a specialist during the week. And yeah, just an awful shame, because I actually thought the game where something seemed to kind of trigger him into life was the West Ham game. Watched the second half of that, and he hit the post, and obviously he hadn't scored the first Premier League goal. But it was almost like during the game, you know, he started getting more confidence, and also as well, he knows that if Dean Smith keeps picking him, there's less pressure on him. I think the goal will come, and then it came against Everton, and you could see the relief, and you're thinking, right, Norwich actually went on a bit of a mini run where you thought they were 1-0 up in Palace, which is the game that the injury happened in, and they ended up drawing that one all. They obviously got thumped 4-0 by City last weekend, and I know we'll get on to the Liverpool game. That's not an easy task going to Anfield tomorrow.
No.
But part of me wondered, was Ida going to be central to a relegation survival tale from Norwich? But yeah, it's not great. And then obviously rules him out for the friendlies next month against Belgium and Lithuania. And you would think that the Nations League games in June now, that looks like that's not going to happen either for him.
Yeah, probably the right thing to do if he doesn't play any club football, not to pick him for those games. But in terms of a back injury for a central defender that's kind of lingering in your early 20s as well, for Andrew Omondale, that's a bit concerning, I suspect, as well, Damien?
Yeah, look, back injury, you'd be far more concerned than a meniscus injury, especially if they haven't been able to get to the bottom of it and you're seeing another specialist. They're possibly not 100% certain with what's going on or the right path to take. The problem with back injuries is it's very hard to rest it, you know, unless you lie down in a bed for a number of weeks, which you might have to do, or you might have to strengthen certain areas. I don't know, but the backs are obviously far more complicated and much, much, much more difficult to get right.
The other thing here, that when we lose two players like this, like Darroch Shea is obviously just getting back to playing football at this stage for West Brom, it does remind us that while we feel when everybody's fit, we've got a reasonably strong sense of depth to the squads, we don't really have any strength and depth at all at the moment as Ireland.
No, I agree with you. I think people like Adam Eder were going to be central to Stephen Kenny's Nations League campaign. Daryl O'Shea hopefully will get back in the West Brom team and have a good run of games and get going. We do have lots of options at centre back. It's probably our strongest area. But look, Stephen will be aware that injuries happen and you have to account for them and you have to just get on with it.
All right, let's get into this. Our poll was, will Antonio Conte still be in charge of Spurs at the start of next season? Only 28.7% say yes, and it's a whopping landslide victory for the no's at 71%. Well, how did you vote?
I actually voted yes.
Right.
I know, obviously, off the back of the interview with Sky Italia, the comments aren't great, but I just see it as Conte just laying down the law saying, this is what I want. What you're giving me at the moment isn't good enough. Tottenham at the moment, the only way they're competing with the best clubs right now is their stadium. They haven't got that right on the pitch yet, so they need to back Antonio Conte in the summer or else he will walk.
Go on.
That's a familiar excuse. He's not the first man to go up against Spurs hierarchy and make demands. I think a lot of Jose Mourinho, certainly Pochettino, have all been down this road before. And I think the surprising thing about this whole issue is we're surprised. I mean, it was a strange take or a strange pick as a manager, an extremely demanding guy that does like spending money, doesn't take no for an answer, combative in his approach to management. Goes into an extremely difficult hierarchy at Spurs. And I think, as I said, the surprising thing is any of us expected anything different out of this. I thought it was a strange pick for Conte, not for Spurs. Spurs would be delighted to have him because he has been known to make wine out of water. When you look, he went to Inter and did a fabulous job. But Spurs are a notoriously difficult club. They don't spend a huge amount of money. The only time they ever spent money in a big way or in a kind of fashionable way was when they sold Gareth Bale. They spent all that money and they think they got that terribly wrong. You know, the year the likes of Soldado and Paulinho came in, not a lot of those signings worked out for them. It looks like they've just gone back to their usual way of just kind of signing players if they can sell, or signing young players that are going to improve and kind of climb in value so they could sell them on at potentially a profit, or just see how it goes. But it's just an interesting one. I would say that when Conte starts doing interviews like this, like he did in Sky Italia, that he's had these discussions with Daniel Levy, you know, that in the interview process, I'm pretty sure that Conte would have spoke to the Spurs board and said, look, I need X, Y, and Z. And Spurs probably given him the old, yeah, absolutely, no problem. You know, of course, we're going to spend the money. The money's there. And then it hasn't materialised. So I think he's gone Sky Italia and he's just kind of a shot fired across the bow, so to speak, of the Spurs hierarchy to say, hey, listen, you know, this is the first move for me now, that if things don't change, I will move on. And there's a guy who will not suffer in silence. He will walk, absolutely, if he feels like he's not making progress.
The one caveat to all of this is that it was just the January window where actually getting rid of the four players that they got rid of. Maybe Brian Hill comes back because he's young and he goes off and plays some football, but getting like Dele Alli off the books at this stage, and he can't have been a happy character around the place. It wasn't a bad transfer window in those terms. Is this conversation with Sky Italia really about making sure that in the summer we get to see that this is him behind whatever happens? And so that's why I would tend to say he will be in charge at the start of next season as well, that this is, it's baked in. He knew exactly what he was doing. He's setting down his template and making sure that the fans know that he is the man, and making sure that the hierarchy knows that he's the man. But like, presumably they have, and they will spend money in the summer.
We've heard this before from Spurs. No, I don't think that's a given, to be honest. Unless Harry Kane goes, unless they do sell Harry Kane for a huge amount of money, then Conte might be given that to reinvest. But no, I don't think it's a guarantee at all.
Their net spend over the last five seasons is quite high. It's like 250 million. Like, they do spend money. It's just they've really wasted it.
Yeah, big time. And what was interesting about the comments, he talked about those four players that left and he described them as important players.
I mean, yeah.
But they're not.
Then pick them.
Dele Alli, he was done. He needed to get out of there. Obviously, and Ndombele is a player with talent, but you could never really see him in a Conte team. Lo Celso had moments, but that's the problem with Spurs. They have players that on the day can be very exciting and scintillating, but issue he has is his defence. Like, he always, if you look at the way he transformed Chelsea, it was built on the three at the back and they didn't concede many goals. Whereas with Spurs, like, they lose to City tomorrow, that's four league defeats in a row. This guy's a winner. He's going to be, he could be standing on the sideline at the Etihad after getting another hiding, thinking, I remember being here a few years ago when Pep had just taken over at City and Chelsea won at the Etihad, and that was the season they won the league under Conte. But things happened so quickly for him that the following season, on day one, he rocked up to Stamford Bridge for the first game of the season against Burnley, the start of the defence of their title. Conte, who wears the nicest suits, rocked up in a tracksuit, basically to say, you haven't backed me, I couldn't be arsed here. And then he finished out the season, he won the FA Cup, but he was gone. And I just wonder, are we going to see something? Watch out if you see him in a tracksuit.
Do you think the Spurs aren't going to spend money though? Because, like, what's the point in hiring the guy and giving him anything between 10 and 20 million, depending on what you read, right? Like, you, as Damien said, you know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah.
What was the point of them?
The Spurs think the Conte is so good that he could perform miracles with the squad that they had. But I don't see how that's possible.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there, Phil. I think that Spurs probably thought they'd get him in. He's a big name, that he can turn water into wine. But again, without being privy to the conversations they had or the interview process that went through, I almost guarantee you that he was given assurances about certain things. Now, when you're trying to change the squad, moving players on is one thing, but you got to replace them and improve the squad. Spurs, and he said this in his interview, he's essentially left them weaker. Now, whether you like Dele Alli or he was going to use him or not, if you're down numbers, then of course you're going to be weaker, and they didn't replace any of the players. Yes, they got out some players who were looking to move on, but he was probably thinking, where's the replacements? And it never came in. So theoretically, they are weaker.
I buy that. Again, because it's January, do you give the club a little bit of a, not a free pass, but you accept that it's difficult to get players in who are at that quality, who want to come? That's the other aspect of it. I mean, I'm sure they're looking at Liverpool being able to sign one of their transfer targets and go,
yeah, I'd say that
we would have signed him, but he didn't want to play for us.
Yeah, and that's where Spurs are at the moment. But the problem is, you're looking at the league table and they have a real chance at top four because nobody is taking ownership of that fourth place. You know, United got a much needed win the other night. West Ham, like, they're very hard to beat, but I think ultimately they won't get enough points to finish fourth. Arsenal look like they're in prime position, but would you trust Arsenal? So it's there for the taking, and it'd be such a frustration for Conte if he doesn't have the carrot to dangle for players coming in to say, we've got Champions League football for you next season.
Have you subscribed to the OTB Football Podcast?
Like, it's baffling, like, absolutely baffling, because it doesn't make them look good, doesn't make David Moyes look good, doesn't make the owners look good, doesn't make the Premier League look good.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast, stream wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
All right, a reminder, this is the football kickoff with Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sports and Premier Sports. The Saturday fixtures that we're looking at, West Ham against Newcastle on BT Sports at 12:30. Liverpool against Norwich on Premier Sport at 3:00 in the afternoon. Man City versus Spurs on Sky Sports at 5:30. It's Leeds versus Manchester United on Sunday, 2:00 kickoff on Sky Sports. And it's Wolves versus Leicester at 4:30 kickoff on Sky Sports. Let's talk about that Man City Spurs game, since we've already been talking about it. If you are Conte, and it feels like you're trying to batten down the hatches and fighting on many fronts, what the hell can you do when your next fixture, after that run that Phil's talking about, what can you do against Man City if you're Spurs this weekend?
Well, ordinarily what Conte would do is he'd circle the wagons, and he'd, as you said, batten down hatches, make life extremely difficult, try and hit him on the counter and maybe smash and grab. But I don't think he's got the players to do that. It's going to be very, very difficult to ask players who aren't used to dropping back into a formation, soaking up pressure and counter-attacking. That's not really what the profile of the player that Spurs have. I think tomorrow, if Spurs get a hiding, which is a real possibility, that, you know, it could be the last straw. That Conte could come up with another interview, and then things get very, very messy at Tottenham between now and the end of the season, and this top four bid falls apart. Conte is such a volatile character. You know, he owes nobody anything, or he doesn't bow to anybody. If he's not happy, he wears his emotions firmly on his sleeve, and it could get very messy for Spurs.
So I suspect you would have been a no voter in our poll then. You don't think he's going to be in charge at the start of next season?
As things stand, I would have said no. I mean, you said there that you know, perhaps you give give Spurs a free pass previously, but I don't think Conte has, hence the reason he went did that interview in Sky Italia, and I genuinely believe that that is the first shot across the bow of Daniel Levy, that I will not stand for broken promises and I will not hang around here, especially when there's a job up in Manchester coming available in the summer.
Well, that's what that was the one thing that kind of wasn't spoken about really in the aftermath of it. Like, is that what this is, do you think? Or certainly, just to make sure that Man United are aware that there's a possibility. Antonio Conte has an 18-month deal, but it's not that big. Who cares? I did wonder, is like, is this a Man United thing that's going on here? Is that what's happening?
Well, people had said, oh, Conte isn't a good fit for Manchester United, and that just cracked me up, because the guy has won the Premier League before. He's won where, is that not what United want? Because clearly they haven't gone down the route of trying to build for the future.
No, they've no interest in that.
No, they're looking
for quick... And they don't know how to do that.
No, they're looking for quick hits.
Yeah.
So Conte would be your man to do that, and United have a better squad than Spurs, and they obviously have the financial backing as well.
What do you think, Damien?
I think Conte is a great fit for Manchester United. Maybe not long term, but Manchester United need somebody to arrest the slide, and they need somebody to grab that football club from top to bottom by the scruff of the neck and turn it around and get it moving in the right direction. And it's going to take a huge personality, a man of immense values, and somebody that the players will not mess with. And I think Conte fits the profile of that. I know I get the fact that Manchester United don't go along this route of this combative type manager, but I think he's exactly what they need in the short term. Put some pieces in place, sort out the hierarchy, everything from... I mean, I looked at a thing online the other day there, and I saw the hierarchical breakdown of Manchester United. It's insane. You've got executive directors, technical directors, director of football. There's an awful lot of people, and you'd wonder how that structure actually works. But if you want somebody to go in there and just clean it out, to streamline that system, because I think that's what it does. It looks like there's an awful lot of chefs there. And I think he's the man, even if it is just for a year or 18 months, somebody to rest the slide and get it moving in the right direction. Of course, the argument of Jose Mourinho will get thrown at me and say that he was similar type. But, whoever comes into Manchester United has to have complete control.
So is there any element of what Antonio Conte is doing somewhat aimed or thinking about at even a subconscious level about the Man United gig?
I don't think there's anything subconscious about it. I think it's out in the open. I think, that it's probably a double-barrel thing for him. He wants to get a message to Levy, but also maybe his agent has that contact from Manchester United and said, look, it's a possibility. Shall we interview for it? And if he's laying the groundwork now to Levy, and this is the thing, he's creating that leverage that, if you don't back me or you don't give me what I want, I am going up the road to Manchester United. And that will leave Levy with a huge amount of egg on his face. And the Tottenham fans will be incensed at that, if they got a world-class manager like him in.
It's good thinking, because Levy doesn't care about anything. He does care a little bit about humiliation. Yeah. That's the one thing that you would say. It's like he'll have a fight with anybody, but he doesn't like coming across like somebody who's second best or has been bested or didn't follow through on stuff. That reputational thing seems to matter a lot. His ego, basically, is huge.
It's all about power with him, isn't it? And look, Antonio Conte, regardless of how things play out with Spurs, he's always going to get job offers. And I know I can see the similarities with the Mourinho and Conte, if people were saying United have gone down that route, but Conte is more current than Mourinho
he
was.
It's more recent, the level of success is.
Yeah, like when Conte left Chelsea...
just last year.
It was, he left as an FA Cup winner, but, things weren't that bad. Where it was when Mourinho, remember when Mourinho left Chelsea the season after they had won the league?
But it completely disintegrated.
It was toxic. It was absolutely toxic. Yeah, so
the physiotherapist issue. Right, well, look, so Man City are going to hand out that spanking tomorrow. Is that what we're saying, Damien? That actually you do think this could be a fairly clinical Man City performance?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think maybe not a hiding, but I think it'll be a comfortable afternoon for Manchester City. And if Spurs aren't quite right and Conte is a little bit agitated, then City are capable of running up a big score.
Okay. The other standout fixture of the weekend that we want to talk about is Leeds versus Manchester United on Sunday at 2 o'clock. We'll come back to the other ones and see what you all think about those. But the Man United situation is entirely predictable and yet still as glorious a soap opera as reality TV has ever come up with at the moment, where the papers today are saying there's a power struggle between Harry Maguire and Cristiano for the soul of the dressing room. This is mad stuff that, like, they get hammered for the leaks coming out, and the leaks come out even more in response to the hammering they're getting, Damien. I can't actually remember a story as glorious and ridiculous as the one that's going on at Manchester United at the moment.
Yeah, I think these type of stories develop when you have a clear lack of leadership. And I think leadership starts from the owners right down. I think if the owners have designated power down to that hierarchical setup that I spoke about earlier, it's just not good because nobody's sure who's in charge. You haven't got an Alex Ferguson type character that's in complete control. And unfortunately to me, it looks like that the lunatics are running the asylum. I mean, that's the way it is. Nobody's answerable. There's, I don't think there's any accountability at that football club. And I think that is one thing that has to change. I think Ralph Rangnick has come in, and I do like him, actually. I like listening to him speak. I don't think he's anybody's fool. He knows the problems that are there. It's just trying to sort those problems out whilst maintaining a push for fourth place. I think that's the battle that he has on his hands. That's the internal battle that he has. I think that if he was given, you know, a long-term project and said, look, let's just, you know, not write off this season, but we're not going to put any pressure on you this season, I think he could clear the decks. But I think he sits and struggles every morning thinking, I want to wipe out so many things, but if I do, it could fall apart. But maybe Manchester United needs to take a couple of steps back before they can move forward. Because I do like him, and listening to him speak, he definitely knows the issues that are at Manchester United. He's honest. But whether or not he can enforce that, because, you know, for someone like Ralph Rangnick to enforce his plans or to enact his plans, he'd need the backing from up above, because he'd probably have to cull some pretty high-profile players. And I'm not sure he has that, to marketable players, because Manchester United are about that at the moment. And if some marketable players are culled, it could be very, very difficult for the club from a commercial point of view.
The thing is, they're rich enough to be able to replace those marketable players is the thing that they could...
I don't know, are they though? I hear this said a lot. Like, I mean, they're businessmen. They're not oligarchs. They're not, you know, like Paris Saint-Germain. You know, the Glazers are businessmen, and they've messed up so much.
Well, that's the thing.
And wasted so much money. They're probably thinking, how much more do we have to keep throwing at this?
Well, so while the club have spent the billion that we see net on transfers, that's the figure that's been bandied about over the last 10 years, they themselves, the Glazers, have taken out hundreds of millions in cash. So as far as they're concerned, that billion was a cost of doing business, and the value of the club has gone from 1 billion to 3 billion. So if they were to sell, they'd be quids in, and they are taking cash out. So I do think that they, if they had, if we follow your logic through, and actually they made Rangnick in charge of something, like running everything, then there might be a plan to the spending of the next billion, and that would make sense. That seems to be in the critical error here. Give Rangnick a title that would have commanded respect and the freedom to act when he came in, so that this interim tag isn't hanging over him, which gives everybody license to go, well, I don't care what you think. You're a nobody here in the long run. You're here for this time. My contract says I'm here for another 3 years.
Yeah, but also they probably would have said we need to finish fourth. And that's the battle that I think he's struggling with. You know, the scenario you said there about, you know, the taking out so much money and spending so much money, there is a loser in that, and that is the football club, because somebody's getting burdened with all that debt. And it's a football club, and I think they must wonder how much can we keep leveraging against this club. As I said, they're not an oligarch, they're not oil money. They don't just keep throwing, you know, endless amounts of money in, and there's no net loss. The club is taking on huge amounts of debt. Servicing debt is costing the club so much money. So there is a loser in that situation. They can't keep doing that. It's impossible. And at some point, the Glazers are going to have to take control of that football club or put somebody in charge that can take control of it.
What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, it's an absolute mess at the moment. And I often wonder sometimes with United, are they better off missing out on the top four because it springs the Glazers into action, where they think, why aren't we in the Champions League? And then you can go back to them and say, well, our squad isn't good enough, now can we have some money? But the problem is they're signing players that are not suited to... Well, Rangnick obviously has a way that he wants to play. He can't do it at the moment, because if you watch United's games, they have a good half of football in them, but they don't have the 90 minutes. But when they fall off, the drop-off, like the first half against Brighton the other night, they were outplayed. Now, Brighton are a good footballing team and probably don't put enough chances away. Whereas you look at the Burnley game, United should have been out of sight at half time, but then they retreat a bit and they get caught. The Middlesbrough Cup game, there was a pattern developing. So it was interesting when it was nil all at half time the other night. You thought, how's this going to play out? And, you know, they got that, Ronaldo got his goal. Obviously, Lewis Dunk gets sent off, and then Fernandes wraps it up at the end. And it felt like there was such relief at Old Trafford. But that's kind of where United are at the moment. In terms of they've so many players on the books now that they can't get rid of because they've paid them too much money.
Yeah,
I was watching Anthony Martial playing for Sevilla last night, scores in the Europa League. He's probably thinking, you know, this is actually great. It's nice to get out of United. Sevilla might win a Europa League here, and the final is actually in Seville. It could be part of this this great history that Sevilla have in the Europa League. Jesse Lingard was meant to leave, wasn't let go to West Ham because apparently they're a rival for the Champions League. So there's so much work to do, and I don't know when some of the leaks coming out, and then Harry Maguire is actually, it's Friday, they have a big game on Sunday, it's Friday morning, Harry Maguire has been on social media this morning basically to rubbish the reports in the paper. Rashford did it during the week as well. United players
not focused on the job at hand.
They're on social media for two reasons: to obviously quash these reports,
and to make money,
and to apologise after a dismal performance,
and to push products. That's the other
thing. Yeah, it's just a mess. But it's amazing though, with a club like Manchester United, though, if they get it right, it can turn around very quickly. Like, it's not all doom and gloom, I don't think, anyway.
Will a trip to Elland Road be exactly what they need this weekend, Damien, on Sunday?
It could be. If they go there, I mean, Leeds aren't in an amazing place at the moment. So it could be kind of a derby of sorts, or a rivalry of sorts with Leeds. And it could be a great game. But equally, if it goes against them, that's how finely balanced Manchester United are at the moment, that we're just kind of operating from minute to minute. And I didn't know that Harry Maguire was on social media this morning. I mean, that's probably one thing, and the number one thing that the club should stop is this constant, you know, talking to fans, you know, and this is what I talk about, having a figure of control, to just call a meeting and just say, this stops, no, you know, we're not apologising, you know, we're not going to explain ourselves anymore. The fans are sick of hearing it. What we need to start doing now is showing them, because we're sick of talking. Whether or not there is a power struggle or not at Manchester United, you do talk about that soap opera. I think a lot of that is kind of, you know, fabricated, because it is such a good story at the moment. I can't imagine Harry Maguire having too much of a rivalry or a power struggle with anyone, really. He doesn't seem like the type. I couldn't imagine Harry Maguire sticking it on Ronaldo. He doesn't seem that kind of strong a personality, or that kind of, I suppose, contentious a character. So I highly doubt if any of that's true, to be honest with you.
All right.
be funny though.
Give us a prediction for this game.
I'll go with a United win. You know, they just seem to be getting goals, and Leeds too aren't in a great place at the moment. They looked really, really tired last week against Everton. Whether Bielsa would give them the rest they needed during the week or not, I'm not sure, but I think Man United would just about get this over the line.
I sometimes feel like Bielsa will respond to his team looking tired by doing 6 weeks of double sessions.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, maybe there's a modern way of looking at this.
I think this could be a crazy game, and the fact that United couldn't have their moments in games where, especially away from home, where they could score some quick fire goals. Leeds can concede goals for fun, and like, look at the Villa game. But the atmosphere
after the Villa game, Leeds were like going to have a great rest of the season, and then they completely collapsed.
They were so bad against Everton, but the atmosphere is going to be unbelievable.
It will.
Leeds fans have been waiting 18 years for this game.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting atmosphere. Let's talk about Liverpool against Norwich. I want to get your take on, and Phil has a theory about the high line that Liverpool are playing at the moment. You were saying that they're the best at it. And
oh yeah, well, I mean, the offside stats show that Liverpool have caught opposition players offside more than 100 times, and the nearest to them then is Manchester City, which is in the 60s. Because it's very strange watching Liverpool be analysed at the moment, and teams get in behind the high line, but it's offside. But there's this narrative that Liverpool are under pressure here, that high line. But they are so good at it. They obviously have the comfort as well of VAR, where they know, because it's usually only Van Dijk and whether it's Matip or Konate, and the two fullbacks are so high up, it's two players that just have to look at each other, know where they are, step, and the opposition. The only way you can counter it, really, look at the Palace goal, where if you've got two runners that can break in, if you've got one runner, even that, Alisson is so good at one-on-ones that, you know, he prevents. The ball has to be that good. But just the Burnley game, for example, just springs to mind, where Liverpool were quite comfortable in the second half. There was a few moments in the first half, but not as many as it seemed, because they're offside. Like, if it's offside, it's not a chance. Even though Alisson might have to pull off a save, it's null and void when the flag goes up. And I know it's a rule, or it's a law that infuriates a lot of people, but it's been brought in because of VAR. But the high line, the risk is far, like the reward is far greater than the risk.
And what do you think, Damien?
Yeah, look, I've had many discussions with Kenny Cunningham on this. Kenny's belligerent in his belief that it's wrong, but I just think that it's because Kenny was, and myself really, were raised as centre defenders to think that if there's any element of doubt, drop, you know, don't take the risk. But again, I think Phil's right, that comes from a time where linesmen weren't very good and there was no VAR. And, you know, obviously there was changing the rules of daylight and centre forwards get the benefit of the doubt. So, you know, perhaps it did suit the attackers an awful lot more. But, you know, offside now is offside to the millimetre. There's no benefit of the doubt anymore, and VAR has just rubber stamped it for them. And on top of that, that statistic there, I did see that 100 times in 60. I mean, do you know how much good comes from that? The risk reward there is Phil's quite right, is huge in favour of the reward to Liverpool, because as that line is if you're holding a high line, I suppose from a technical point of view, and there's time on the ball, you can get picked off, because if the player in midfield or the centre back has time on the ball, he can get his head up, get it out of his feet, make eye contact with the centre forward, and you can time the run perfectly. You try that with Liverpool and their counter press. So when you win the ball back, you don't have time to get it out your feet, get your head up, make eye contact with a centre forward, because Jordan Henderson is absolutely snapping into you, and it's very, very difficult. Usually you're tired because Liverpool have worked you and kept the ball for a period of time. Then when you win it back, you don't have the composure to get it out your feet. Everybody says play through the press. That's a lot easier said than done with Liverpool. So there's a lot of elements that are in Liverpool's favour. With this high line, as I said, there won't be a whole lot of quality. Usually it's just a one-touch ball that's spun around the corner, and the centre forward's chasing a lost cause. Now, if the one time they get it right and that ball that's spun around the corner, or the press isn't quite right and someone does get their head up, you know, they believe then that they have Alisson, and if you can beat Alisson, then I think Liverpool will give you a round of applause and say well done. But it's so few and far between.
Yeah, and that's actually something Klopp said after the Inter Milan game. He said it's not done, the tie, but if they go to Anfield and are amazing at the Beatles, then fair play to them. And yeah, even, you know, with the high line, if the ball, like, Klopp is never going to turn around to his two defenders, his two centre halves, and say, that's your fault. No. He'll say, why was the ball left be played? Like, so
100%.
Yeah, no, it's
good to have the best team in the world playing as well as they are for you to be able to say, well, if they beat us, fair play to them.
Yeah.
It's like a nice, comfortable situation he finds himself in.
Like, I'm fascinated by it because it just takes such nerves where, like, who blinks first, and they just the look that Van Dijk usually gives the assistant, where he kind of looks over, go, why didn't you put the flag up earlier? I had to track back there.
Yeah. The football kickoff with Sky, all the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport, and Premier Sport. We're live every Friday morning around about 10:30. We've got like 60 seconds left on West Ham, Newcastle, and Wolves, Leicester. Newcastle are going to be safe, are they? The signings seem to be working out, Damien.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're on a good run of form. It's could imagine what the city of Newcastle is like at the moment. It must be like Mardi Gras every day of the week. So that type of goodwill and energy in the city, and the team's playing well, and the signings have come in. They've done really, really well, and I fully expect them to finish mid-table.
Wolves versus Leicester, Phil. Are Wolves the new Leicester? Is that what's happening here? They're supplanting them as the team most likely to make a breakthrough?
Yeah, but I mean, I know...
enjoyable to watch.
Well, when Leicester won the league under Ranieri, the 1-0s were... There was a lot of 1-0, especially on the run-in, and Leicester, or Wolves rather, don't score many goals. They don't concede many, so...
You're telling me this is a 1-0 win for Wolves?
It could be, and you know what? It could be a set piece, because Leicester cannot defend them. Rodgers even brought on Vestergaard last week to defend the set piece, and the guy is 6'6", and he still couldn't get the ball out.
They've got the yips.
Definitely do, yeah. It's a thing. Like, you've been in a team before where, you know, every ball that comes into the box,
it's going to be goal.
So it's Hail Mary stuff.
Were you ever in any of those teams, Damien?
No. Set pieces are okay for me. I quite enjoyed them, to be honest with you. So, sometimes it can be psychological, but if you can't figure out a way for your players to defend set pieces, be it zonal, man for man, or as you said, a Hail Mary job, it's very, very difficult environment to be in.
John Jones on YouTube says, yeah, Jose Mourinho was great when he had all the best players and loads of cash. In fairness, he didn't have all the best players and loads of cash when he was at Porto, and he was an absolutely amazing manager for a period of time. It's just that that time passed. Right, here's the Football Kickoff's five-a-side team this week. Each week we're asking you on Instagram, so follow us on Instagram to choose your five-a-side team made up of players competing in this weekend's games. Fabianski versus Dubravka. Fabianski won that. Romero versus Diaz. I think Diaz had 90-something percent. Pogba versus Click, another 90%er. Ruben Neves versus James Maddison. This one was a bit closer, but Ruben Neves wins. And Diogo Jota versus Timo Pukki. Guess who won that? It was Diogo Jota, funnily enough. That is this week's episode. We're glad you were with us, Damien. Great to have you with us. Phil, thank you very much. Thanks. Enjoy the weekend's games. We'll see you next Friday at 10:30. Take care.
The Football Kickoff
with Sky. Watch every single live Premier League game on Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sports.
You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code pod20 for 20% off your first product.